It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Prepare this hour to wrap your mind around some very simple questions that have left us humans clueless, or nearly clueless. My guests today are PhD comics creator Jorge Cham and particle physicist Daniel Whiteson. They've teamed up on a new book to explain everything we don't know about the universe. Cosmic rays, dark matter, time travel, Big Bang. It's called We Have No Idea, A Guide to the Unknown Universe. And we'll get to some of the questions that they tackle in just a moment. Let's meet Jorge Cham, is creator of the popular online comic Piled Higher and Deeper, popularly known as PhD Comics. He happens to have a PhD in robotics from Stanford. Jorge, are you there?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for joining us. Daniel Whiteson, professor of experimental particle physics at the University of California in Irvine, and a fellow of the American Physical Society. You also conduct research using the Large Hadron Collider at CERN in Switzerland. Daniel, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us on.
Before we dive into some of these questions, there are far too many to get to this entire hour, but tell us, what is the approach you took? You have a lot of humor, whimsy, wonderful illustrations by Jorge, a lot of humor here. What did you want to do with this book?
We wanted to touch on the basic human curiosity, to understand the world we live in and the history of it and our place in it, to get a better sense of the human situation. So we tried to tackle, instead of talking about all the things we do know that you see often in science books, we tried to give people a tour of all the open questions, the things people are currently exploring, the things that motivate scientists themselves. And these are questions that are very basic. You know, the people should be able to understand why these questions are important. They're the kind of questions my children ask me. You know, where did the world come from? What is it made out of? So we were hoping to convey that excitement in a way that was understandable.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the cover of your book here. Let's start there, because this is the way the book starts, with the universe. We have a pie chart on the front cover here, a pie chart that represents the universe, that it has three, I guess, sections it's broken up to. 5% of it, this little sliver, is stuff we know. 27%, a larger slice, is termed dark matter. And the 68% remaining is labeled no clue. So tell us, that 5% of stuff we know is everything that we know, planets, stars, everything.
Hamsters, pickles, ice cream, etc.
Pies.
Everything, yeah, everything that we've ever studied, that we've been spending hundreds of years trying to understand, turns out to be an unusual and little slice of the universe.
How do we know it's so small? Well,
that's a great question. And so, and it touches on something which I think is really interesting, that we have a very accurate measurement of how much we don't know. It's an era of precision ignorance, a precise measurement of our lack of knowledge. And it comes out of just looking out into space. We can look at all the stars and the dust and the galaxies, and we can add that all up. And then we notice that there's another kind of matter out there. Dark matter was discovered when people were looking at how galaxies spin, and they noticed that galaxies spin much faster than they should if you add up all the stars. And the only way to explain it was to hypothesize this crazy idea that maybe there's this huge blob of invisible matter at the center of every galaxy that's pulling on them hard and making them spin faster. It took about 50 years before people were really willing to accept that idea, because it's sort of crazy. It's crazy for people to think that the universe is different from what we experience, that what we see is not typical or usual, but unrepresentative, and that we shouldn't generalize from the things we've learned to the whole universe. But now we know that's true. If you add up how much mass it has to be out there to make the galaxy spin the right way, then it's 5 times as much mass as all the stuff we've seen, the stars and the hamsters and the pickles. Mm-hmm. And even adding that all up, you only get about a third of the energy in the universe. But 20 years ago, people were looking at the universe and trying to understand its history and saying, if the universe started from a huge explosion, the Big Bang, then what happened afterwards? Well, you imagine maybe things would slowly drift out from the center and then gravity would pull it back together. And the question people had was, is there enough gravity to pull it back together into a big crunch, or will things just drift out forever? And when they went out to measure this, they found out that the answer was neither. In fact, things are flying away from us faster and faster every day. So So there's some huge amount of energy being used to rip the universe apart, to push galaxies away from us even faster. And you can calculate how much energy that is, and it's twice as much as all the other stuff, the dark matter and the normal matter.
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about dark matter, and I think, Jorge, in your blog today, you had a comic strip that played around with this idea of dark matter. Like, can you put it in a box, right?
Yeah. So I think people said when they hear dark matter, it's usually in the context of the hearing about space. And so I think we thought people had this idea that dark matter was out there, you know, kind of like black holes or distant galaxies. But actually, dark matter is kind of all around us. It's kind of sits on top of the universe that we know of, and it's kind of flowing through us probably right now. Like at this very moment, your listeners are probably bathed in dark matter.
Okay, so you say probably, but this is just the best sort of theory we have at the moment. We're not 100% sure that there is dark matter, or are we?
We know that there is dark matter. We're very positive about that. We know how much there is. It's hard to know exactly where it is because it's invisible. The only way we can detect it is through its gravitational effects. But since gravity is so weak, you need enormous, like, galaxy-sized blobs of it in order to see it. So we know that there's a lot of dark matter in the center of our galaxy, and we know that it spreads out all the way through our galaxy and actually extends even further beyond the visible stars. So the whole galaxy is sitting in what we call a halo of dark matter. That doesn't mean that there might not be pockets, whereas the Earth maybe is in a bubble that doesn't have dark matter. But more likely than not, there's dark matter everywhere, and it's flowing right through us. The incredible thing is that because we can't see it, it's sort of like two universes on top of each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what the dark matter is or what it's doing, but it's right here. And it could be complex. It could be totally boring, a single kind of particle, or it could be really complicated. It could be lots of different kind of particles interacting with each other, and there could even be dark biology and dark life and dark radio shows, for all we know, happening right now.
Does this have anything to do with antimatter, dark matter?
It's just another kind of mystery. Dark matter and antimatter are two completely separate mysteries about particles. It's a great point, though. Dark matter is a new kind of matter we haven't understood yet. We don't even know if it's made of particles. Antimatter, we know that exists, and we can create it, and we can study it. We know it's a thing. We just don't know, why is it a thing? Why does every particle have an antiparticle?
How do we know it's a thing?
Because we've created it and studied it.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen antimatter in real life. It's not a mystery. It's not a the fact of its existence is not in question. The question is, why is it there?
Well, one of the questions. Yeah, go ahead.
It's this weird symmetry, right? Every particle seems to have an opposite, and that seems like a big clue as to about how the universe is made. On one hand, it seems symmetric. Every particle has an opposite. On the other hand, our universe is made out of matter and not antimatter. Like, the Earth is made out of matter instead of antimatter. We don't know why that is. Why matter, not antimatter? Why does the universe prefer one over the other?
Are the replicates, the match, are they necessarily next to the piece of antimatter, or can they be anywhere?
Well, the antimatter, we think we can create it in the lab, but there's almost none of it left in the universe. And if there was any antimatter nearby, it would annihilate very quickly, because when matter and antimatter come together, they blow up into a blinding flash of energy. You often hear about antimatter in science fiction, and science fiction gets a lot of things wrong, but antimatter is actually one of the things that usually gets right. Matter and antimatter together are like a huge bomb. So if there's any antimatter left in the universe, it would very rapidly run into matter and explode.
Okay. We're looking at some very simple questions with heady answers, much of it unknown. Daniel Whiteson is with us, a particle physicist, and Jorge Cham, they are the authors of a new book, We Have No Idea, A Guide to the Unknown Universe. Fascinating. Jorge has lent a number of, well, illustrations throughout here. A lot of humor in this book. Very accessible. Before we go to another idea here, tell us about part of your approach had to be making it accessible. How did you approach that? Because this is a very accessible book. It's a fun book to read. You can pick up, of course, any number of books about particle physics and put them down very quickly, unless you are, like you, Daniel, a particle physicist, right? Because you just can't understand anything.
Yeah, that was kind of our mission with the book is, you know, we think that people are often very intimidated by these kinds of topics. When they hear the word physics, they have, you know, kind of cold shivers maybe a little bit. But we really wanted to write a book that was accessible to everybody. You know, everyone, even with a mild interest in or curiosity about science or about the big questions of the universe, we really wanted to write a book for them, and so that, you know, even kids or young readers or all the way through adults and older people, or anyone with, you know, people with a PhD or people with no background in science could read this book and kind of be engaged with the questions and the excitement of discovering these answers.
No, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, so the cartoons are kind of part of it. The book is written in a very accessible way, and there's a lot of cartoons if you're intimidated by all the text.
Love the cartoons. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and our approach was to kind of have fun writing it so that hopefully when you're reading it, you also have fun learning about this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about time and space, which you address in this book, and it's tied in with a lot of the other questions that we've already talked about. But the simple question, and you point this out in your book, is that some of these questions are so close to us that we don't even think to ask it. The question, what is time? I thought about that when I saw that here. I said, what is time? What is your definition of time, Daniel?
It's a great question. It's one I always love thinking about. It's these really basic questions that I wonder about. And before we talk about exactly what time is, I like to think about how in the future people will think about these things differently. And it might just be that we're asking the question the wrong way. And if we thought about it using another phrasing, another perspective, maybe things would make a lot more sense to us. Or if we connected two things, which seem unrelated. But the question of time is a fascinating one, and my view of time is that the universe is like a series of snapshots. The universe is what it is right now, and then a second later, it's something else. And imagine a movie, right? A movie seems like a continuous experience, but it's really just a bunch of snapshots that are ordered and sequenced. And so to me, time is that ordering and that sequencing. You connect this universe that we have right now with the universe you're going to have soon using the laws of physics. It does the job of telling us how the universe changes from now to 1 second from now to 100 years from now. So time is that ordering and sequencing of events in the universe.
Mm-hmm. And you ask the question here, why does time seem to always move forward?
That's one of the deepest questions, right? We like to think about time in connection to space, and Einstein told us that space and time are connected. He tied them together into a concept called space-time. And when you do that, a lot of things in physics make a lot more sense. But it also raises a lot of deep questions. For example, in space, you can move all around as you like. You can go back and forward to your car and, you know, move in and out of your bed or jump up and down in your house. There's no limits to how you can move through space. But time is different. You can only move forward in time, and we don't know why. You can't easily affect the speed with which you move forward in time. Right? Wouldn't it feel weird if you were moving through space at a constant speed your whole life? That would feel really peculiar. But that's your experience of moving through time. So if time is really just a fourth dimension of space, then why is it so different? There are a lot of really strange ideas about what time might be. Mm-hmm. Some people think time is just a measure of how much longer the universe has until it reaches its eventual endpoint, which is the heat death of the universe, when all entropy has taken over the universe. Other people think there might be more than one dimension of time, which is sort of even hard to think about. What does it mean to have two directions of time? The kind of ideas out there are hard to grasp because they're so alien to us and they're so alien to our experience. But the important thing to remember is that the universe is not designed by us, and so the truth of the universe can be completely counterintuitive to our experience. And this has happened lots of times in the history of physics. Quantum mechanics took a while to figure out because discovering that the universe at its smallest scale is neither particles nor waves, but these weird probabilistic objects is very counterintuitive. Mm-hmm. But nature is no stranger to weirdness.
And Jorge, you make some wonderful illustrations, and I think they make the point here about there are things that we can't imagine, perhaps. You take a creature, I'm forgetting, Jorge, what creature it is, and put it in a sort of a two-dimensional two-dimensional existence, right? It can only move along a line.
I think it was a ferret.
Is it a ferret? A ferret, yes. And so that ferret, what is the point you're trying to make with a creature that lives in two dimensions, since we live in three dimensions?
Yeah, we were just trying to get people to grasp the concept that there might be more than the three dimensions we're in. So it's kind of weird to think that, you know, we currently know about up and down, left and right, front and back, but it's weird to think that maybe there's another dimension. So in addition to these three that we're kind of moving around with, is it possible that we're also kind of moving in another direction, in another dimension? And so the way we try to get people to understand that is to, let's think about, like, let's say that you imagine you're stuck in a video game, you know, on the screen, on a flat screen, or you're stuck as a cartoon character in a flat sheet. You know, you would spend your whole life in this kind of flat space thinking that that was all there is to it. But really imagine one day you discover that you can not only move around in that page or that screen, you can also kind of pop out of it and explore more space. That's kind of the feeling that you would have if we discovered or were able to move and think about this another dimension of space.
Mm-hmm. So Daniel, with this sort of mental exercise, we could be three-dimensional creatures just unable to really imagine, except for some very few of us, that there could be a fourth dimension?
Exactly. There could be a fourth dimension. There could be a fifth dimension. There could be 11 or 26 dimensions. Because the world we have in our minds is based on our everyday experience, we tend to think of it as if the whole universe is this way. But we should be careful about overgeneralizing from a tiny little sliver of the universe and our experience to imagine that these are universal rules. We could be in a three-dimensional section of the universe, or we could be three-dimensional beings in a higher dimensional space that we just can't measure.
Wow. These are fun questions to think about. I'm looking at my colleagues here, and we've got all kinds of expressions on our faces. These are fun discussions to have.
Exactly. And one of the things we wanted to get at with the book is to allow people to think about these questions, because they're exciting. You don't have to know the answers to think about why the questions are interesting. And I like to fantasize about the things we might discover and the ways we might look at the universe. And sometimes I'm so desperate to know the answers, I wish I could fast forward 500 years in physics and just read a textbook, you know, from 500 years in the future, because the answers are there, right? I mean, the universe works a certain way. It's not like philosophy where you can smoke banana peels and argue for hours and not necessarily make any progress. There is a true answer to these questions, right? Like, take the question of aliens. Either there is intelligent life somewhere in the universe, or there is not. One of those is the truth. But either answer is incredible, right? Either the universe is filled with alien life out there, which is mind-blowing, or we're the only intelligent species in the whole universe. Which is more incredible, I'm not sure. But one of them is true. So I love thinking about these questions because it's tantalizing to know that we could one day know the answer.
Mm-hmm. We have 3 or 4 minutes before we have to take a break. We'll pursue that a little bit more, because your question in this book is, are we alone in the universe? And really, when you talk about these questions, having being unknown at a certain point and becoming known, we have made huge strides just in the last decade in identifying Earth-like planets. How many out there that we know are Earth-like? Not to say they're exactly like Earth, but in some sense, they are candidates for supporting life.
Yeah, great question. This is something that's really just come about in the last few years as we've gotten good at looking at other stars. Right now, we think that about 20% of stars, 1 in 5, has an Earth-like planet, meaning a planet that's rocky and that gets about the same amount of solar energy as ours, so not too cold and not too hot. That doesn't mean they have life on them. That's the open question now. It doesn't even mean that they're really, you know, suitable for life. We don't know if they have nice beaches and good weather, et cetera. But 1 in 5 is a huge number, because there are 100 billion stars in our galaxy and trillions of galaxies. So 1 in 5 means a lot of Earth-like planets. If there's no life on any of them, that would mean something really special happened on Earth.
Mm-hmm. And your bet is what, Daniel and Jorge, that there is life out there? We just haven't contacted it yet?
I would love that to be true. Sorry, go ahead, Jorge.
No, I think I also would love that to be true. You know, I think the odds kind of speak in favor of there being life out there. Mm-hmm. But, yeah.
I would love that to be true. I wish we could say more about it. The only problem is that we have just one data point. It could be that life happens one every trillion Earth-like worlds, or it could be one every two, or one every 10. We really just don't know. We don't have enough information to say. We're learning a lot about how life started on Earth, but they're really simple, basic questions we don't have answers to, you know, those first moments of how life started. My wife is a biologist. She knows a lot more about this than I do, but I'm always asking her these kinds of questions. I just really wish we had more information. If we found life on one more planet, that would tell us a huge amount about how often life happens.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, Daniel, that might happen in our lifetimes, let's say the next 20, 30, 40 years? That would you be surprised if we found some sort of life, perhaps even in our solar system in some form?
I wouldn't be surprised. I would be very excited. We have lots of tools that are just coming online, like the James Webb Space Telescope and other space telescopes that are going to let us look at the atmosphere of these Earth-like planets and understand, is there water in this atmosphere? Are there chemicals in those atmospheres that can only be made by metabolic life? But another thing to consider is that so far we're only talking about the kind of life that we're used to, biological life, carbon-based, chemical, organic life. We should think more broadly. We should think that life can have lots of different forms. It could be, you know, there could even be life in dark matter, right? There could be life in the center of stars with this huge amount of energy. There could be self-replicating energy currents. I mean, we're venturing deep into speculative space here, but we should think very broadly and be careful not to generalize from our kind of experience.
Jorge, when you illustrated this and worked with Daniel on this project, what was a big challenge? We've got about a minute before we have to take a break, but what was the biggest challenge for you as an illustrator and creator of PhD Comics?
Well, it was a ton of fun to do these. I guess one of the challenges was to just kind of try to boil down these complex topics and try to present them in a cartoon or an illustration that really kind of captures the essence of the point we're trying to make in the text.
Mm-hmm. A quick question from Bob in Muscatine. What's the difference between dark matter that you're talking about and ether, as we used to talk about it? Daniel, is there any connection between dark matter and ether?
There is a connection. Both are vast hypotheses that would explain things we didn't understand. Dark matter, however, we're pretty sure about, and ether has been disproven.
Okay, Daniel Whiteson is with us, a professor of experimental particle physics at the University of California, Irvine. Jorge Cham is a creator of the popular online comic PhD Comics. They are authors of the new book, We Have No Idea, A Guide to the Unknown Universe. We'll be back in just a moment. I want to find out why we can't travel faster than light. When we come back, we'll talk about gravity and is there a theory of everything? I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. We're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Wrapping our minds around some very simple questions. What is time? What is space? Are there more than three dimensions? And many of these questions have left us humans clueless or nearly clueless. We're talking with Jorge Cham and Daniel Whiteson, particle physicist Daniel Whiteson of the University of California in Irvine. Also, Jorge is a PhD, perhaps you're a fan, PhD comics creator there, making a very accessible book to some very big questions that have stumped humankind so far. As we heard in the first half hour, Daniel saying, He wishes he had some kind of textbook 500 years in the future, when he's saying a lot of these answers will be there for us to see. Let's talk a little bit about one of the questions that you have in your book, why we can't travel faster than the speed of light. We have an illustration here by you, Jorge. It's like a speedometer here. It's labeled meters per second. At the bottom, 0.3 meters per second, you've got a hamster. This is how fast a hamster can go, at about 300 meters per second. Rocket cars getting up there a little ways on this scale. Bolts of lightning, very fast. At the top of the scale is light, which is 300 million meters per second. I learned it as 186,000 miles per second, okay, whichever one you prefer. And then after that, you've got the mark on the speedometer. After the speed of light, 300 million meters per second, it says absolutely nothing, never, no way, no, nothing goes faster than that. Daniel, why not?
That's a great question, and we really don't know the answer to it. It comes out of a really amazing experiment. People discovered that no matter who you are or how fast you're going, light always travels at the same speed. So light also can't go faster than light, but it also never goes any slower. So that's a basic thing about the universe. Light always travels at the speed of light. It doesn't matter how fast you're going. So two people traveling at different speeds, measuring the same light, will both get the same answer, even though they're traveling at different speeds. Mm-hmm. So we don't know why that is. Mm-hmm. But it's a natural consequence of that fact that nothing can go faster than light.
Tell us some of the weird things that happen, that can theoretically happen as we speed up and approach the speed of light.
Right. So the only way we understand this is using Einstein's theory of relativity. And it makes sense mathematically, but it's very counterintuitive because in our world, we never travel anywhere near the speed of light. I mean, even Usain Bolt is much, much slower than the speed of light, right? Even the fastest airplane or spaceship is a tiny fraction of the speed of light. And as you get faster and close to the speed of light, the universe starts to seem weird to us, right? So as you get close to the speed of light, time slows down for you, and you get heavier and heavier. If you could ever actually approach the speed of light, then time would stop, and you would get infinitely heavy. Of course, that's impossible. Nothing that has any mass can ever go the speed of light. Only light can go the speed of light.
Mm-hmm. So it's impossible to say, I would hitch a ride on a photon. That doesn't work.
That's right. That doesn't work. No. You can use photons to push your spaceship like light sails, but you couldn't actually jump onto a photon.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, too, that I could leave the Earth and return after traveling to whatever percentage of the speed of light. In some setup, I could return to Earth younger than my children.
That's right. A lot of time could have passed on the Earth while you were traveling. And I think one of the most interesting facets of this is understanding why the speed of light is what it is. It's very, very fast compared to us, which is why it took us thousands of years to notice that there is a speed limit. But as far as we know, there's no reason why it is that number. It could have been twice that number or a tenth that number. We have no theory in physics that tells us it has to be this number. It's like, imagine a universe control panel somewhere that somebody was designing our universe. They just set it to this number. As far as we know, it could have been something totally different. Mm-hmm. And it would have big consequences. If the speed of light was much, much faster, we could see further into space. We could travel to other stars more quickly. The universe wouldn't seem like such a big place. If the speed of light was much smaller, we wouldn't even see as many stars in the sky. The night sky would be darker, and everything would seem impossibly distant.
Well, this has implications for what we were talking about in the first half hour, is are we alone in the universe? If we can't travel in the speed of light, then after a certain distance, it really doesn't matter, or in a way it doesn't matter if there's life out there, because we could never contact it. We could never communicate with it, right?
That's right. Yes and no. Yes, in that if there's life out there, it's probably impossibly distant. So even though I think it's more than likely there is life out there, I think it's very unlikely they've ever visited Earth because it's so far away. And even having a conversation could take hundreds of years, right? And imagine sending a question and then getting the answer back in 200 years. Society would be totally different. We probably wouldn't even understand why we had asked that question. But there are loopholes. You can't travel through space faster than the speed of light. But space is a squishy thing. It's not just an empty backdrop. It can be squeezed and distorted, and it can be weirdly connected. So wormholes are a thing in science fiction, but they could actually be real. We could find ways that space far away is actually connected to space here, so we could travel to there without breaking the speed limit.
Uh-huh.
So it compressed space between here and there.
So it gets to another question you have in your book, which is how big is the universe? Talk about that. How should we imagine that? Because we can't imagine, we imagine it going out infinitely, and we can't even imagine it stopping because there's something after whatever that would be, right, that would stop it.
That's right, yeah. We don't know how big the universe is. We don't know what's out there beyond the edge of the universe. We don't know if the universe goes on forever or if it curves on back on itself, or if at some point there's just nothing else.
I wanted to ask you two a little bit as you write this, have written this book. It's very accessible to science. Science has had some troubled times here in the last few years. What do you think of the fact that in this day and age we have marches for science? You are two scientists. We feel the need to protest. Some of us do in support of the role science has in public policy and society. Any thoughts on what's behind the new skepticism of science?
Jorge, you want to take that one?
Sure. You know, I think I looked at these events not so much as a protest, but just kind of as a rally in support of science. You know, I think it's very important that we have kind of a common basis of understanding of what reality is and how we determine things to be true or not true. And so I really just saw these rallies as kind of a cry from people to say, "Hey, let's listen to the facts. Let's figure out what the facts are."
Mm-hmm. How did we put the facts aside in some cases and have a less of an emphasis on the facts? For instance, is the scientific community at all at fault in the way it portrays science, not raising awareness enough about scientific work, or raising it the awareness in the wrong way, Daniel?
I think that's a hard question to answer. You know, I think most scientists are just trying to focus on the questions they have and trying to provide information to society and to politicians. And then it's a separate question of how that information is used. You know, not all scientists are great communicators, and not all communicators are great scientists. That's one of the reasons why I partnered with Jorge, because I couldn't have written this book by myself. I thought to convey the science to the general public, it would be great to work with somebody who had excellent artistic skills as well as a scientific background. And I think that what we've produced is better than what either of us could have made individually.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, We Have No Idea is the title of Jorge and Daniel's book. We Have No Idea, A Guide to the Unknown Universe. Very simple questions. What is time? What is space? Can we travel faster than the speed of light? Trying to say not only what are the things we don't know, but why we don't know them. Talk a little bit, Jorge, about what Daniel just said, working together. Describe how you worked together on this project, the roles that you played, the sort of kinks, the challenges you had to work out.
So Daniel has, 20-plus years of physics experience. And, you know, I'm an engineer. I have a PhD in robotics. But I was kind of new to a lot of these things. And so it was just a really enjoyable and fun process of just kind of – it was really just kind of having conversations about these things and then figuring out what are the things that we know, what are the things we don't know. And it was kind of really important for us to not just kind of state what were the things we didn't know or knew. We really wanted the reader to kind of come away with an understanding of why we know these things or why we don't know these things. And so it was really just a really fun and collaborative process.
One of the questions you look at in your book is, what is the smallest unit of matter or stuff? I thought we knew that with atoms, but that's not the case, Daniel?
No, in fact, atoms are a pretty big object when you're talking about the smallest units of matter. Inside the atom is the proton and the neutron, and surrounded by a whizzing cloud of electrons. The protons and neutrons are made of quarks, so these are up quarks and down quarks. So to make all the matter that we understand, you need up quarks and down quarks and electrons. Those are the smallest things we found so far. However, that doesn't answer the question, are they the smallest things possible? To see inside those particles, we need even more powerful colliders, which are essentially like microscopes to look inside particles. And one deep question is there a smallest particle? Can you keep dividing things smaller and smaller and finding smaller and smaller particles? Does it go on forever? Or is there a fundamental basic Lego of the universe out of which everything is made? Like with aliens, either answer is kind of incredible. It would be amazing if particles just went on forever, infinitely small. But it would be sort of bizarre if there was the smallest piece of matter. I think most scientists would guess that there is a smallest piece. There are some arguments that the smallest piece of matter should be around 10 to the minus 35 meters. That's 0.0351 meter, which is a tiny, tiny, tiny digit. So far, we've probed down to about 10 to the minus 20 meters. So we're 15 orders of magnitude away.
Is there a way you can give us a sense of how small that is? I mean, it's so small, perhaps there is nothing we can imagine that small.
Yeah, if we can probe down to minus 10 to the 20, if that was the size of the solar system, you know, then the smallest unit of matter would be about a meter. So we're really, really far away from getting to the scale of where we think the smallest piece of matter might be. But again, it's just a speculation. We think there might be a smallest piece of matter, but we're not sure.
And this
consequences either way, you know, is the universe pixelated? Is it built out of Legos or is it continuously smooth? That's a pretty basic question about the universe we don't know the answer to.
And you've worked at this amazing place, the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland, and this is where it's really happening. You are breaking down units of matter.
That's right. We smash protons together against other protons and try to look at what's inside them. And sometimes the particles inside them annihilate and create new kinds of matter that we've never seen before. For example, the Higgs boson was discovered there 5 years ago. So the incredible thing about a particle collider is that it's capable not just of tearing apart matter and showing you what's inside. It's capable of this incredible alchemy, like alchemy in terms of turning one kind of matter into another kind of matter. So if it exists anywhere in the universe, if it's possible to make it, then we can make it at the collider just by pouring enough energy into the collision. So that's the goal, is to explore the universe by trying to create all the kinds of particles and then looking for patterns in those particles and getting clues as to what the fundamental structure must be.
You talked about the universe, our galaxy, and so forth here. You addressed the question here as we get toward the end of the program. You talked about Big Bang. That's one theory of how things began, that there was just this very dense matter that then exploded and is continuing to accelerate and expand in its acceleration. But let's talk a little bit about the end of the universe, which you address in this book, too. What do we know about the end of the universe? Will it have an end?
We don't know a lot. Currently, it looks like dark energy, which is this mysterious force that's tearing the universe apart, will continue and spread the universe out so that eventually, you know, if you look up in the night sky in 10 billion years, it'll be mostly dark because things will have been pulled out of our sphere of observation. Imagine if we had evolved in 10 billion years instead of today, and we looked up at the night sky and didn't see any stars. We would have no clue as to what the universe was made of or how it was organized, right? And then I like to think backwards and think, well, what if we had evolved 10 billion years ago? And what would the night sky have looked like? What clues in that night sky are we now missing? Are we totally ignorant of because we evolved so late in the universe? But we don't know, will dark energy continue? Will it turn around? We don't know what dark energy is or what's controlling it or how it works, so that it really anything could happen. The universe, it could turn around and start compressing the universe. So we really have no way to speculate in a solid fashion about the future of the universe. But for your listeners, you know, you can safely go to work tomorrow and we're talking billions of years in the future.
What are each of your favorite questions in this book of questions with unknowns here? Do you have favorites here, Jorge?
I do. I really like the chapter about cosmic rays. So cosmic rays are these particles that are hitting the Earth all of the time. They're kind of showering the Earth and hitting it. And some of them we know where they're coming from. Some of them are coming from the sun and things like that, and they're coming in sort of kind of regular energies. But we're also being hit by these little tiny particles that are going so, so fast that nobody really knows what could be shooting them that fast. And so for me, that's a really kind of very concrete mystery. Like we're getting somebody shooting at us, and we don't really know what it could possibly be causing them. They could be a new kind of star or a new kind of maybe aliens trying to kill us or get our attention or something like that. It's just this very kind of concrete mystery where the possibilities could be pretty exciting.
The chapter you're talking about is titled, Who is Shooting Super Fast Particles at the Earth? In which you learn that space is full of tiny bullets. You had a lot of fun illustrating this part, too.
Yeah.
We have famous rays you have here. Ray Charles, Ray Bradbury, and then the cosmic ray, and hooray. There's a good example of the humor here. I found myself chuckling a lot reading this book and so forth. What about you, Daniel? Do you have a favorite question in the book that you've created with Jorge?
I think they're all really fun, but I guess I have to admit that I voted with my feet. I spend my personal research career working on the question, what is the universe made of? To me, like, if somebody told me that they knew everything and I could answer one of the, I could have the answer to one of these questions, I think it would be, what is the smallest particle? To me, that's just such an urgent, immediate question when I look around the world and I wonder, how is this thing organized? What are the rules by which it lives? And that's, I guess, why I became a particle physicist.
Yeah, well, what would that tell us if we knew the smallest unit of matter? What would that matter?
I'm not sure it would change the way we live our lives, but it might. You know, learning, for example, that the Earth is not at the center of creation or not even at the center of the solar system changes the way we see the human situation and changes the way a lot of people live their lives. So if we discovered the fundamental organizing principle of the entire universe, you know, the universe is like essentially this tiny Lego block and this one rule, now go, I think that would really peel back layers that have been hiding us from understanding what the truth is of the universe. And I certainly would like to know that how it would affect our lives depends on what that answer is.
Mm-hmm. That's closely tied, I think, you kind of dancing around the question you have in the book. Is there a theory of everything? That's what you think you would discover?
That's the goal, right? The fundamental goal of physics is to get everything onto a T-shirt. We want an explanation of physics that can be so compact and simplified that it explains everything in terms of a simple rule you could fit on.
What does that mean? Would that be a formula?
Yeah, a formula that says, here's one particle and here's how it interacts, and everything else, all the complex emergent phenomena, hamsters and ferrets and Ray Charles and all that stuff, just comes naturally out of that. To me, it's incredible that the universe, as complex and as infinitely varied as it is, can be described in terms of a few basic building blocks, right? This whole principle that complexity can be described in terms of simple objects is astounding. Why do we live in that universe? It turns out we do. And in a universe like that, I want to know, what is the simplest, most core little kernel that explains the whole universe?
Among scientists, the more you know about particle physics or whatever, does it make you believe in a greater being more or less the more you know?
That's a great question. To me, it's sort of separate from science. I'm looking for questions that have hard, solid answers and using tools we can use to reveal those answers. So to me, it's astounding that the universe makes sense and that it seems to make sense to humans. One question I have is, if there was a theory of everything, say aliens came to visit and they had the theory of everything, could we even understand it? Is it possible for humans to grasp the universe? These are philosophical questions I don't have the answers to.
Mm-hmm. Now that you have this project under your belt, do you have a new one that will follow on the heels of this one, Jorge?
Yeah, we're thinking of maybe other kinds of any other kinds of books. Maybe a follow-up call. We still don't have any ideas.
We had a lot of fun making this project and a lot of fun bouncing ideas around. And we were hoping that the fun we had in writing it came through in the book. And so we're definitely planning to do more projects like this. It's so much fun.
You mentioned this before, Daniel, but perhaps in the 30 seconds we have there, are there any of these questions we will never know the answer to, or do you think we'll know the answer to all of them? Not we, but at some point these answers are knowable.
I think the answers are all knowable. We are at the mercy of the universe sometimes, and then we have to look around and find clues as to what the answers are. The universe is not arranged in a way to make it easy for us to unravel its mysteries. Some of them may never be unraveled just because of the way the universe works. But I never want to stop, so we're going to keep hunting until we figure out as many as we can.
Okay. Thank you for spending the hour with us. Daniel Whiteson, a professor of experimental particle physics at the University of California at Irvine, fellow of the American Physical Society. He, as we talked about, conducts research at the Large Hadron Collider in CERN, at CERN in Switzerland. Jorge Cham is a creator of the popular online comic Piled Higher and Deeper, popularly known as PhD Comics. He has a PhD in robotics at Stanford. Jorge and Daniel, thank you so much for joining us. It's been delightful.
Thanks very much.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. You're now